Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and this is the return of the Sunday Roundup. Hurricane Irma has been devastating the Caribbean, where several British overseas territories are to be found. In particular, Anguilla and the British Virgin Islands have been badly hit. The Defence Secretary, Sir Michael Fallon, discussed the British response to the hurricane with Andrew Marr.
We've seen images of British troops and others arriving now. Why were we so late?
Well, first of all, we weren't late. We pre-positioned a ship in the Caribbean for the hurricane season. It wasn't by chance that Mounts Bay, a huge 16,000-ton aid ship with marines, with helicopter, with pallets of aid, was already in the Caribbean. She's already been helping Anguilla. She's already moved on to help the British Virgin Islands. Now, it wasn't until Thursday when we were clear about the where most help was needed and when we were clear which airfields were usable. Then we started the airlift. Three flights went in on Friday, two went in yesterday, three more are going in today. We're putting in troops, we're putting in additional helicopters and pallets of aid backed up by police, medics and engineers.
We saw those pictures on the news of landing craft arriving on White Beaches, which was said to be Anguilla, but somebody from Anguilla, Dot Hodges, there says that nobody has actually landed. Have we landed in Anguilla?
Absolutely. Mounts Bay was on Anguilla first and has restored power on Anguilla and has helped deal with the fuel situation there as well. Mounts Bay was then able to move on to the British Virgin Island, has started to provide assistance there. There are troops on the British Virgin Islands today. 120 troops are already there. Our task force is established under a brigadier. There are 500 British troops in the region now.
And yet there have been quite a lot of voices from the islands and indeed in Parliament as well. Lord Naseby, one of your colleagues in the House of Lords, and Tom Tugendhat from the Defence Select Committee have both said that our response has been too slow and slower than France, slower than Holland.
Well, that's not true. The French didn't have any kind of ship like Mounts Bay. They had a couple of light frigates there. They had the advantage of having troops. They garrison their overseas territories, so they had troops already in position. We have local police forces on these islands, but our response has been as good as anybody else's. And indeed, I can tell you the French have asked now for our assistance in helping to lift troops and material to some of their islands.
So Tom Tugendhat simply wrong. He says our response has been found wanting, requires improvement, and there's been an apparent lack of forward thinking.
No, I don't accept that. We had the Mounts Bay was not there by chance. We pre-positioned our ship there to help on the islands. She's already been helping on the islands. And as soon as we were clear which airfields could be used, we then got our flights in. We have troops helping at the moment.
Aside from Hurricane Irma, Brexit has dominated in the TV studios today. The Institute for Global Change, founded by one Tony Blair, has published a report with a view to reducing immigration to Britain without leaving the European Union. Blair outlined these proposals to Marr.
Lots of communities up and down the country, all up and down the East Coast, for instance, parts of the Midlands and the Black Country, were changed very, very fast. And people didn't understand that.
Yep.
And the question, I suppose, is do you accept that among all the reasons for the Brexit vote, that was part of it?
I accept that EU migration, including from those accession countries, was obviously a factor. I do think it probably isn't the biggest concern on immigration, but here's what I'm saying now, because we're not 13 years ago, we're 2017, the circumstances are completely different, and we've had the Brexit vote. If, for example, the anxiety is pressure on downward pressure on wages as a result of an influx of EU migrants coming and doing work, say, in the construction industry. We have it within our power to deal with that by domestic legislation. In addition, for example, now there is a directive being supported by the French president that would specifically bar the undercutting of wages and local bargaining from EU migration. So if we want to deal with those questions, we can deal with them without the sledgehammer that, as it were, through Brexit, destroys the EU migration that we'll actually need, because my paper shows that we actually need most of these EU migrants. And it doesn't, of course, deal with the other parts of the immigration issue, which I think are the greater concern.
But nonetheless, the British people voted to take back control of their borders. So any change in internal EU migration would have to be quite a dramatic one. Can I ask you whether you see any sign whatever that any of the leaders of the EU or the national leaders are prepared to revisit what is one of the four pillars of the EU free movement?
I think there are signs, and I've just given you one, which is specifically dealing with this issue of undercutting of wages. I think you could go and back and argue in Europe today for example, an emergency break that didn't just deal with benefits, but also dealt with the influx of people. And I think there are things that we could do domestically, like registering people who come in and those that go out. I think you could probably get a restriction on those that come.
We tried to do this in 2016 under David Cameron and failed.
But this is post the Brexit vote. And the thing that I'm saying is that Brexit is a distraction, not a solution to the problems this country faces. If members of Parliament really believe that, then their obligation is to set out solutions that deal with the actual problems communities and people have, and not do Brexit, which is actually going to distract us from those solutions and going to cause real economic and political damage.
Speaking to Sky's Niall Paterson, Justice Minister Dominic Raab defended Brexit voters' concerns on immigration.
It's difficult to see where progress has been made. We haven't made progress as it stands in terms of the financial settlement. We don't appear to have a plan in place as regards a transitional agreement, even if the Cabinet now finally agrees with it. I mean, the draft immigration plan that was leaked this week, I mean, that went down like a bucket of cold sick in boardrooms up and down the country. National Farmers Union, Hospitality Association, TUC, I mean, the problems that you have on your plate at the moment are getting bigger and bigger.
The first point you made is there's been no progress. David Davis went to the House of Commons this week. He gave a statement. He pointed to some of the areas where we've made progress on EU nationals and their rights here, UK expats abroad. That's very important for the certainty and the smooth transition. We've also had, I think, a gradual coming together on the Northern Ireland issue. And, of course, on Monday, we vote on the EU withdrawal bill. One of the great opportunities of Brexit that many people voted for was to take back democratic control over our laws. That's what we're doing come Monday night.
We'll talk about that in just a moment. But in terms of the immigration plan that was leaked this week, I mean, if you're going to get to that target of tens of thousands, you're going to annoy a huge number of people in a variety of industries across the country. That, at least, is fair.
And what we're going to do is give effect to the referendum. And also, I think the widespread public opinion that thinks, not racist, didn't have 17 million racist people voting for Brexit, but wants some command and some control over the immigration system. And we can do that in a sensible way, which gets the best advantages for the economy and for businesses, but also exerts control over the overall numbers, make sure people that come here are self-sufficient, and let's face it as well, make sure, particularly at a time of heightened security concern, we've got proper checks around the border. I think that's a sensible plan, and of course, the detail of it's being worked up, and I'm not going to comment on leaked reports in newspapers.
OK, so we don't know what the divorce bill is going to be. We don't know what's going to happen with immigration. I mean, it's little wonder that the EU negotiators team are starting to lose their rag with you.
Well, there's been all sorts of personal jibes and suggestions that the British people for voting for Brexit were stupid and need to be taught a lesson. I'm not going to engage in any of that. I think it's unprofessional. We want to be good friends with our European partners at the end of this, and that's what we're aiming for.
And finally, Ken Clark has reacted to leadership speculation in the Conservative Party in his characteristic style.
These days, we're never far away from comments about the Conservative leadership. Jacob Rees-Mogg perhaps damaged his chances this week with some choice words on abortion. Given the party's direction on the European Union, given the words of Mr. Rees-Mogg, I just wonder, would a young Ken Clark naturally gravitate towards the Conservative Party?
Well, I joined the modernisers in the Conservative Party at a time when we were campaigning for Britain to join the European Union. There's an irony about my career. In my first Parliament, Britain joined the European community. It's benefited, I think, for the 40-odd years that I've been in politics. My last Parliament, we're deciding to leave it for a lot of silly populist reasons. As you say, everybody turns to the leadership. When the Conservative Party can't think of anything else to do, it tends to have a leadership crisis when it's rather puzzled by policies. And the reason is, I mean, I'm quite aware of the fact that the things we've been talking about in this interview, they're complicated, they're quite difficult. They concern investors and trade union leaders and businessmen more than the ordinary member of the public. The Eurosceptic campaign has offered simplicity. This dangerous, changing world, all these foreigners living here now, all Brussels' fault, leave the EU, one bound we're free, and a brave new world will emerge. Well, that is nonsense, and it's no good diverting ourselves by saying would Jacob Rees-Mogg be a 21st century Prime Minister, which I suspect Jacob thinks is rather a silly question, certainly at this stage of his career. I'm afraid the government has to be given as only the powers required to manage a transition. We've got many years of complicated negotiations in front of us. Our economy is in a very worrying state. I mean, we have slowed down very badly. The outlook is very uncertain. We need as soon as possible an assurance that economically and in trade terms, our arrangements with Europe are going to carry on for some years as they are now, so that this can all be sorted out sensibly. It's our children and our grandchildren we should be thinking about, not next week's newspaper headlines. And can we have fun with a kind of strictly come dancing type contest between people who want to be Prime Minister? Theresa May is there. There's no prospect of her being replaced by anybody sensible in any sensible process for the next 2 or 3 years. Theresa's got the job of presiding over a smooth transition through a long transition period to an arrangement that at least will minimise the damage in a few years' time.
That's all for this week. I'm Isabel Hardman, and this podcast was produced by Matthew Taylor. Don't forget to subscribe to the Coffee House Shots podcast on the iTunes store, and you can get a great deal on the magazine with the first 12 issues for just £12, plus a limited edition Spectator moleskin notebook. Just visit spectator.co.uk/podoffer.